There was a time that prevailed through most of human history when people lived in small little villages and they would send representatives out into the world who would come back and tell stories, sometimes true and sometimes not, of what the world out there was like. And you would rely for your information about the world beyond your own experience on these shlichim, these messengers, who would come and tell you about foreign lands and different people. It was a different time. Because when I was walking around the congregation this morning and people said, "We hope you'll tell us what happened in Washington," I thought, you can see it on your computer. You can see it on Twitter. Look on the Facebook page. There's all the stuff. The problem with going off and having an experience and coming back is people already know. And the truth is that what you bring back to people is not information, but impressions. I can't tell you any more than you could read in any of 1,000 different sources at the push of a button about the political maneuvering, the agreements and disagreements of this or any other AIPAC conference. Not only that, but if I'm going to be entirely honest with you, and I am, but don't tell anyone, if you spliced together the speeches of the last 7 or 8 years from AIPAC conferences, you wouldn't know which year was which speech. And that's not because the speeches aren't thoughtful and wonderful and good. They are. It's that Israel's problems haven't changed. So Iran must not get a nuclear weapon could be from 2010, 2008, 2012, 2014. The dilemma grows more acute, more serious, more urgent, more frightening. But the resolution doesn't change. If I said to you, someone gave a speech about how Israel needs a real partner for peace, you could say, was that from 2001? From 1980? Or from this conference? What's impressive about the conference is less the specifics of the political issue than the larger impression that you get when you are there that lets you understand something about Jewish history that is both urgent and important. In other words, it threads its way through our people and also matters as much today as it ever did. One thing you realize is that even in the age of two primary poles to Jewish life, Israel and the United States, our concerns and our people are global. The issue of Russia and the Ukraine also managed to thread its way through the conference, not only because of Jewish life there, but because pull on any tendril of international relations, and somehow the thread leads to Israel. And you recognize that the express purpose of the Zionist dream, at least one piece of it, is completely unrealistic. The idea of self-determination. No country in the world can succeed in being entirely self-determined. We are too interconnected a world And you can't say anymore, I don't care what anybody else thinks, we're just going to do what we want to do. We have discovered you can't do that in the United States, you can't do that in Russia, you can't do that in Israel. Which means if you have a small besieged country, which alas we do, you have to care about everything. Not only what goes on in your area of the world. And so one thing you realize that is part of Jewish history is that Jews have never been able to be truly parochial, even when they've wanted to. They couldn't say, let's just care about ourselves and not pay any attention to what those other people are doing. We have been, by choice and mostly by compulsion, a universal people forever and ever. This is why a friend told me Jews became so prominent in the diamond trade. I don't know if this has ever occurred to you, but it's true. Even now, people in the diamond trade who are not Jewish often use Yiddish expressions with one another. Why is that? Because if you're trading internationally something valuable and you can't always tell what the value is, I'm sure your diamonds are real, but I mean other people. You need to find in a country you've never visited and a town you've never been in a person you can trust. Jews had an international network, do have an international network. And that's because if you would write Jewish history properly, you'd have to speak every language in the world. And that's why when you talk about Israel, there's no country that's off the table. You can't say, let's talk about Israel, we can ignore the continent of Africa. Let's talk about Israel, who cares what happens in Crimea? In some ways, a Jew is a universal human being. Because throughout our history, the world, for good and ill, has taken an interest. And so one of the things you see at AIPAC is this remarkable array of people from different backgrounds and different languages and different experiences who somehow come together to care about our country. And that is the second important historical fact that AIPAC brings home that transcends any particular political question. And it's especially important for Jews in America to know this, which is that America does not care about Israel because American Jews care about Israel. Let's not congratulate ourselves too much. We're important, we're not that important. As you see, representatives from Wyoming, from Nebraska, from places where there are fewer Jews than are sitting in this congregation this morning in people's districts, talking about how important Israel is to America, you recognize anew that AIPAC is the American Israel Alliance. That in fact, the same core values that animate this country animate Israel. And that they are the only two countries that I can think of that were created not by a population but by an idea. And that is a very powerful thing. And part of that idea are the ideals we share, the heritage of Western civilization, of freedom, of law being more important than personality. And of course, the common heritage that Judaism gave to the world. And so we're a universal people, and we are a people whose ideals tie Israel and the United States together, not because Jews care about it, but because the bedrock of what we believe is the same. And then there is the special Jewish message that again goes back to the Bible. I know that shocks you that I'm saying the Jewish message goes back to the Torah, but it does. And it's about us who are sitting here this morning. Because when the tribes cross the Jordan and go into the land of Israel, remember there are 2.5 tribes, Reuven, Gad, and Chatzi Menasheh, that say, no, you know what? We're going to stay here. And if that shocks you, all I can tell you is that that has been a pattern throughout Jewish history. Why is the Talmud called the Babylonian Talmud? Because even when Jews went back to Israel, a lot of us stayed in Babylonia. We all know that Cyrus brought the Jews back to Israel, allowed them to go back. So why are there still Persian Jews? Because some of you didn't go back. Some of you had nice connections and lives where you were, and so you waited until you could be members of Sinai Temple. A couple thousand years, more or less, among Jews, not so long. And American Jews the same. In 1948, those who didn't study enough Jewish history thought, oh, every Jew is going to go back to Israel, but people don't work that way. So some did and some didn't. But remember what Moses said to Reuven, Gad, and Chatzi Menasheh. He doesn't say you can't stay there, you have to go to Israel. You got to visit. But he doesn't say you have to go. He said, okay, you can stay outside the land of Israel on one condition, and one condition alone, which is you have to fight for the land. That is the tax you pay for your anti-historical choice not to live in Eretz Israel. That's what you owe. And what does fight for the land mean? Fortunately, in this morning's parsha, there is an answer. Whatever parsha it was, I would have found the answer, but it happens to actually work really well this morning. I don't want you to think that had we not been reading this parsha, there'd be no answer. The first word of the parsha is Vayikra, and he called, referring to God's call to Moses. And the strange thing about it is that for some reason, the final letter of Vayikra, the Aleph, is much smaller than the other letters in every Sefer Torah in the world, going back to the oldest manuscripts. For reasons that we don't know, the Aleph is smaller. So let me tell you the reason given by the Baal HaTurim, Yaakov ben Asher, in about the 1400s, 14th century. He said it's because what Moses really wanted to write was Vayikar, which means God appeared to Moshe. But God said, no, I want you to write that I spoke to you, not that I appeared to you. Because Moses remembered that earlier that same word, Vayikar, was used with Bil'am. And he wanted it for himself. But God insisted that he add the Aleph instead of appeared, called. But Moses, being upset at the idea that he had to add the Aleph, decided, okay, God tells me to add it, I got to add it. But he didn't tell me how big to make it. So I'm going to make a little Aleph just to show I'm not so happy about this. And I thought, what a beautiful analogy. The truth is, what Israel wants from us is that we should be there, Vayikar, that we should appear. You know that. Anybody who's seriously involved with Jewish life always has to ask themselves, why have I not made Aliyah? And you have to answer that to the satisfaction, or at least to the quietness of your own conscience, for whatever reason you give. But if you don't appear, you have to add, even if it's only a compromise, that little aleph. Which means that in the absence of showing up, you have to make sure your voice is heard. What AIPAC was about is the call to conscience for American Jews to support the state, because we know that in an interdependent world, if we don't catch the ear of people who will share our values, if we don't explain to senators, to congressmen, to people who did not grow up with the consciousness of Israel that everybody in this congregation grew up with, who did not hear the stories of the founding of the state at their mother and father's knee, that if we don't tell them, they will not know, and they will not recognize that in some ways Israel is an outpost of everything we love in the midst of a neighborhood that represents so much of what threatens what we hold dear. That's what AIPAC is. It is raising the voice again and again and again so that we might catch the ear of those who don't yet know. So when the Prime Minister stands in front of 14, 15,000 people who have all come to Washington for these couple of days, and he says, I go to field hospitals where Syrian refugees are running from the civil war, from one of those countries that we're supposed to make peace with, and we treat the refugees and they say they've been lying to us, and we say to them, what do you mean? This is what they answer. They told us Iran was trying to save us, but now we see Iran is helping to kill us. And they told us Israel was trying to kill us, and here I am, and I see that Israel is helping to save us. When he says that, it's our job to magnify his voice, to make sure the rest of the world, and especially our representatives, our congressmen, our neighbors, that they hear that they know that. Because we're Reuven, Gad, and Chatzi Menashe. We're the people who live outside the land, and therefore we have a responsibility to fight for it, and the way that we fight for it is through our voices. Think of an organization like AIPAC as a megaphone, and you'll get it right. But actually, it's not one megaphone. It's thousands upon thousands upon thousands of them, and in places where that voice would otherwise not be heard. Would it be heard in Los Angeles? Yes. Would it be heard in Wichita? Not so sure. But now it is. And that's what went on in Washington. I didn't come back to tell you there was this disagreement or that disagreement. We liked this position that the administration took, and people didn't like that position that the administration took. You can make up your own minds. I don't have to tell you what to think about politics. But the one thing that I do know, and this is not from attending AIPAC, this is from a study of Jewish history, is it is a sin and a crime for a Jew to be silent. That we are not allowed to do. And if you want to know where I heard that most eloquently, it wasn't at AIPAC. It was what I did the day after I came back. I came back from AIPAC on Wednesday, and Thursday night I went to the dinner for the United States Holocaust Museum in Washington that was here in Los Angeles. And there you heard what it's like when the world is silent. You know what it's like. All you have to do is open the newspaper. You know what happens to people in a world in which there is evil and there is silence. So that's the message. That's what I heard. That's what I saw when I saw our kids, all the alumni from our schools, the hundreds of people from our congregation who went to APAC. What I saw and I heard were people who have no interest at all in being silent. Vayikra is the call. And that is what we're asked to do. To visit, to write, to speak, to care, to call. That's what it was about. Everything else is subordinate to the responsibility that every American Jew has to agitate on behalf of the only Jewish state that has ever been or will ever be. This is it. We don't get another chance. And so in the face of real threats, of genuine threats, of what he said over and over again, but unfortunately truly existential threats, we can't be silent. You saw this morning something about which our grandparents and great-grandparents only dreamed. Young Israeli men and women who come to the United States to tell us why they live there. I have to tell you, if you had asked my great-grandfather if he needed an excuse, if there was a Jewish state, for someone to come and explain to him why he lived there, he would have thought you were crazy. Of course you would live there. It's Israel. But we know that ideals and reality don't always mesh. So since we're here, we owe them the responsibility of not forgetting that they and their parents and their children are the ones who do the real fighting. We're just asked by Yikra to call. I hope that what I bring back to you, along with all of you who joined us there, is a renewed sense of purpose, and also, I hope, an invigorated hope that ultimately there will be peace, but that certainly there will be strength, both true material strength and also spiritual strength, to sustain what is still, despite the fact that we may grow accustomed to it, what is still in the perspective of Jewish history an extraordinary miracle. The existence after thousands of years of a place of which our ancestors did not even dare to dream. So we call, we write, we contribute, and we do one other thing, sitting in this congregation on Shabbat morning. We pray. Please rise.